So yesterday I introduced the theme briefly for the retreat. It's called the five faculties, the five capacities or abilities that we all have that get evoked and used and to support us in this process of a path of liberation. And so today, we're going to take the middle one, mindfulness, and talk about mindfulness, partly because it's a mindfulness retreat, so to kind of introduce this topic to support you and get you going here on the today. And also, it's very nice that mindfulness is considered to be the balancer of the other four, and that the other four you can have too much or too little of. You can have too much faith, blind faith, and you can also have too much wisdom, so they say, you know, too much, you know. And so one's more cognitive, wisdom is usually more cognitive, and faith is more, usually more emotional. And the idea is to have those in balance. You can have one or one imbalanced. And also it's possible to have too much energy but not enough calm or concentration, and those two are supposed to balance each other out. And if you have a lot of calm, a lot of concentration, but no energy, that's also doesn't work so well. So that's the wonderful way, and these need to be in balance with each other. And mindfulness is said to be the great balancer of them, partly because we see how they're imbalanced and we can make sometimes an adjustment. But there's something about magical about the power of awareness, that just to be aware, clearly aware of what's happening, tends to bring our life into balance, into harmony, into wholeness, into a variety of things. It tends to there's something about something very powerful about awareness. It's kind of like a miracle to be mindful and to just be aware. It's kind of like the whole psychophysical being of who we are responds to awareness, just like we would stand in this in a cold day, stand in the sun, and we respond to the warmth and kind of, you know, thaws the chill we might have. So there's something about awareness which is kind of like the sun on our psychophysical being. And it's not a passive thing. It's not like just passively accept things as they are. But there's something about the very process of being clearly aware that begins to shift and change and move our system to some kind of healing, some kind of freedom, depending on what's needed. And it's probably a kind of a petty example, or a silly example, but it's maybe a little bit like, these jack-in-the-box things. You have stuff to pour jack-in-the-box into the box and put a lid on. But you take the lid, pop the lid open, it finally gets all the tension in that spring gets released, and it pops up, and the spring is happy, right? Because it's no longer, crunched down there in the box. So there's so much of our life which awareness kind of gives space to things to move, to unwind, to reveal themselves, to show themselves, to do what they need to do, to something. And so I like to think of awareness as a breathing room, giving lots of breathing room to our life, to what goes on, lots of space for things to begin to unfold. And it's been one of the great joys and awes of my practice in life, is how much I don't need to be in charge, and how much that if I create the conditions, that there's a powerful movement within of the Dharma, I like to think of it as a Dharma, who knows what that is, but it's kind of like a nice, for me, a warm feeling, but some powerful movement of nature, a natural process of healing, as I said earlier, and freedom, and liberation, release, development, growth, making space for some of the best qualities of who we are that come forth when we make space for it, when we see it, when we hold it in awareness. I believe it's very hard for some of the mental forces and thoughts and ideas we have that debilitate us, that undermine us. It's very hard for them to operate when there's the sun of awareness, when they're really seen clearly for what it is, because we don't really buy into them. We don't really engage in them. So this morning we had this incident with Anton, and it's a kind of incident that we hope doesn't happen here at retreats. But periodically on retreats, things happen that we wish don't happen. And sometimes it's, you know, some medical thing, and some, a range of things that might happen. It's not that common, but occasionally they happen. And, you know, sometimes it has to do with facilities. In one retreat I was teaching, there was no water for, it was a 2-week retreat, I think, and for 10 days there was no running water. And so we continued having the retreat, and somehow, you know, we made do with that and took care of it properly. But it was one of the best retreats, you know, and it worked really well because somehow it rained most of the time. So there was no running water, but it rained. And so everyone became very focused and very really there. And afterwards, I was blamed for ruining the pipes, the plumbing, so I could, for the sake of the retreat. And then they said, Gail, you probably did this. And sometimes, you know, all kinds of things can happen. And what I've learned over this time, and I don't know if it's the case today, but what I've learned is that when these things happen on retreat, it more often than not tends to bring a beneficial result in the end, and tends to be for the better for the people who are most affected by it. And the best way I have for understanding this is that we're bringing awareness to what's going on. And when we're bringing mindfulness and awareness to our reactions, our responses to what's going on, the stronger the reaction, the more there is to learn, the more there is to see about ourselves and to find out what's happening, what we're attached to, what we're afraid of, what our desires are, what our expectations are, what our self-identity issues are, and all these things go on. And so, and generally, when we're in this kind of environment, we're bringing awareness to it, it doesn't. It's not so easy to perpetuate blame or hostility or self-criticism or, you know, being stuck in an opinion or being caught in an emotion or kind of just. It's just because you have a lot of space to see it, and you start seeing. Oh, you know, look what I'm doing here. I'm holding on, I'm criticizing, I'm blaming, I'm doing something. And so we tend to kind of step back, because it hurts to do that, so we step back from doing it, and we allow things to unfold, the emotions to unfold and do what they do, be processed. We kind of are looking for another way of being, not to be caught up in greed or hate or fear or desire or whatever it might be. And when we stop kind of engaging or investing in those forces, then the better sides of us tend to come out. And there's a deeper understanding of ourselves that goes on. And the stronger the reaction, sometimes the more learning there has been, the more people unfold. And that's what I've seen over and over again. It's a remarkable process. So it used to be that as a new teacher, I got all worried. Oh no, something terrible has happened. And now I'm quite concerned, and I hope we took care of it today adequately. I don't want to say that I welcome these things, but that wouldn't be right. But I certainly appreciate that there's, in this context and environment, that something can happen here that often can't happen, doesn't happen as easily in normal life when we don't give the space, we don't bring the attention to what's going on, we're not working with what's coming up for us and being with us. And instead, we might be distracted a lot, we might be so caught up and involved with our life in many ways that we don't see that we're blaming or angry or attached or being the victim or being whatever. It's harder to see sometimes. And so it can go on for years and years, some of these patterns of how we are. But here, the idea is to be aware and to see. So in addition to whatever this happened this morning that we all were part of, you all had your own private little, probably a little crisis, I don't know, or the challenge you had. How many of you today were more tired than you expected? That's a lot. How many of you had a headache? How many of your body hurt more than you expected? How many of you didn't meditate as well as you thought you would the first day of a retreat? And how many of you felt discouraged today? And some of you didn't raise your hand. Why? Anyway, this is often a part of the first day of a retreat. It's quite normal to have these things happen, especially tiredness. I can't tell you how many retreats I've warned people. The opening evening, the first day. The first day you'll be really tired. It's common. It's sometimes called the swamps. And don't take it personally. Be gracious about it. Just offer the best you can, but don't get discouraged. And sometimes I get the impression that no one listens to me. because even old timers who know better, have gone through this before, are kind of caught by surprise. And so we're so easily pulled into judgments about it or taking it personally or something. So we all have, our thing that goes on here the first day. And one thing I'd like to mention for new people, because I think for some, the silence that we have, social silence, not talking, for people who've never spent this much time in silence, it can be really weird to do it and to be around people this way. And so, for example, in ordinary life, if you sit down at a dining room table with a group of other people, they're already there, and you're the last one to sit down at the table, and while you sit down to eat, everyone just looking at their food, and no one says anything to you, even recognize you've sat down. In the ordinary life, that's bad news. But here, it's not bad news at all. It means that people are probably good news. They're engaged in the practice, they're eating mindfully, they're just focused on their own thing. And they were not involved in social communication here. But if you bring the understanding, the interpretations we have in daily life to here, then it's bad news to be in the dining room here. And it's very easy to kind of bring the old rules, kind of old understanding, and interpret here. But here, people are basically kind and nice, and no one's ignoring you actively, and it kind of, it just means that they're engaged in their practice. But it can be strange. I know people have told me very explicitly that, that dining room thing can be really weird if they're not used to it, or the silence. So if those things happen to you today, just know that it's part of the territory, and it just comes with it. It's being new, and that inevitably it'll change over the next few days. And it's not uncommon for people who were challenged by the silence the first day, by the end of the retreat, don't want to give it up. What? We're going to break silence? No, stop. No, hold on. So it all shifts and changes. One of the nice ways of looking at a retreat like this is to think of it as a journey. And if you just keep showing up and keep being on the long journey, things will change and unfold. And the more you give yourself over to the process of the retreat, the more that journey will unfold for you. The more steps you take, the more you allow the transformation, the change to happen. The less you engage, in it, the less you'll do what you do. But giving yourself over to it as fully as you can, which tends to have the best results. So the topic for today is mindfulness, and the word is sati. Sometimes I think it's better translated into English as awareness rather than mindfulness. And it's one of the most remarkable capacities of a human being to be aware. And I feel like very fortunate to have spent much of my adult life kind of in the playground of awareness, in the territory of awareness, learning about it, studying it, being affected by it, being opened by it, just a whole world of being aware. And there are times when I feel very acutely that awareness and love are the same thing. There's something about the process of simple, direct awareness that is like just being in love, or having love, or just being love, being present, being intimate, being here. Maybe because of the human capacity for empathy, for caring, for compassion, for love, is an innate capacity that when all the scales fall off, or all the filters fall off, or the attachments and the resistance and the fears fall away, that's what we're left with. And so we're left with love and awareness in a way that just seems inseparable from each other. It's a beautiful thing. I think in many times in ordinary life, the awareness is not appreciated very much. Mindfulness is not really appreciated so much, because what mindfulness means, what awareness means, is that to appreciate it, to understand it, to feel connected to it, we can't be lost in our experience. We can't be preoccupied in our thoughts, preoccupied in our activities, or our feelings and emotions. And an analogy I like to use is that of, holding a striker. I use it because I'm often sitting with a striker. It could be anything. But if the striker is something I'm very attached to, really important for me, then I might hold it really tightly. I might be afraid you're going to steal it from me because it's a good striker. And so I hold it really close and tight. And in my preoccupation for the importance of the striker, I'm so focused on the striker, what the means and all kinds of things, that I don't notice how I'm clutching the striker, how I'm holding it tight. But if someone of you said, "Gil, have you look at your hand? How's your hand right now?" "Oh, it hurts, it's tight, it's cramped, it's numb, and so then you might say out of compassion, "Gil, if you just relax a little bit your hand, you can still hold it, but you don't have to grip it so tight." "Oh, look at that." And so I release. And so what's happened there is, rather than becoming focused on the striker, I become interested in how I hold the striker. And that is that's the understanding how I hold the striker is the path to a certain kind of inner freedom, or physical freedom in this case, that's only found by focusing on how we are with experience, not what the experience is. So part of what we're doing here is shifting from being concerned about things to how we're concerned, from thinking about things to how we're thinking, to focusing and being concerned, being aware of things to how we're aware. And many times we're not aware that we're aware. We're just so busy doing things that we just take it for granted that we're aware. But to really slow down, to be attentive in such a way that you know you're aware, that the awareness stands out, "Oh yeah." That begins creating space for the things to unwind, to open up, to show themselves. It begins helping us see the how we are. And one of the things we start discovering in the how is if we're caught, preoccupied, attached, clinging, afraid, resisting, all kinds of ways in which we can be contracted or tight or frozen and to see that, and to see it, and then just to see it. And part of the wonderful art of awareness and mindfulness is learning the ability to only be aware. Just aware. And you might almost use that as a mantra during the retreat. Just aware. Let's just be aware of this right now. Just aware. There's certainly times to do other things besides just being aware, but there's something phenomenal, powerful and significant about learning how just to be aware. Whatever is happening at this moment, to be aware. If there's a sound in the room, just to be aware. If there is an itch, start off by exploring, what does it mean just to be aware? Just to be aware. If there's a pain in the body, just to be aware. And one of the things we'll learn in this just to be aware is how much we're more than just aware. And that's part of the function of this practice, is discover all the things we add in addition. Judging, wanting, not wanting, being for something, being against something, trying to analyze it, trying to judge it, trying to avoid it, we do all this stuff besides just being aware. And so that's dropping that little mantra, just aware, can begin helping you to see what you're doing and what's going on. And it might also help you understand, to feel or to experience how significant it is just to be aware. Just things begin, you know. There are things that can happen to you that happen best if you get out of the way. If you're not the cook in the kitchen, kind of, you're trying to, the second cook or the third cook, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen. And so if, you know, there's something wonderful if you're not, if you don't always take responsibility for yourself, but in this environment, and just kind of, just be aware. Oh, okay, I'll be aware of this. Be aware of this. So, we, you know, be aware of your breathing. Just be aware of the breathing. Whatever it is, just be aware. And one of the things that we're learning through this process is the qualities and characteristics of awareness and of mindfulness. And how it operates and different ways it can operate for us. I think one of the great benefits I've received from my years of practice is to appreciate that awareness is not a thing that's, you know, unitary, singular thing. You're always aware, always mindful the same way. But rather awareness, mindfulness, attention is multidimensional. It's multifaceted. It takes different shapes at different times. I think of it like water. You pour water into a container and it takes the shape of any container you pour it into. So awareness has no shape and form by itself, but I don't know if exactly the analogy works out well, but it can take different shapes depending on how it's used or how it's understood or how it's, you know, approached. Or and it's learning the different ways to be with awareness is part of the art of doing this. And I'm using here the word awareness and mindfulness interchangeably. And I'll explain a little bit later why I do that. But I want to present with you four different ways that you can be aware, or four different ways of being mindful, using analogies that the Buddha gave for mindfulness. And you get a sense of how it can shift and change. And doing that, maybe learning that you can kind of, each situation you're in, you can kind of explore, what kind of awareness do I use so I can just be aware, so I'm not entangled or caught in the situation. The first that I talked about was that of being on a mountaintop or a high tower, looking down at the drama of the people below in the city and the towns. And, you know, if you're right in the middle of the town and the drama of it all, you might get caught up in it and swept away in it and involved. But there's something about standing at a distance and looking from a distance where you can see what's going on, but you're a little bit more of a detached or non-attached observer of it. And you're not engaged in the details. You're not caught in it and involved. And you can kind of watch it in a more relaxed way as an observer from a distance. And so you can see clearly what's there, but you're not engaged and involved. Well, certainly that kind of distant observation could be seen as being aloof, but that's not what's meant. But one of the ways which some people find this very helpful is if there's very strong emotions on retreat, like there's a lot of, you know, anger and fear are the ones that are most pronounced for this exercise. And that is to, if it's hard to be with, then imagine how far away do you have to stand from your anger or your fear so you're willing to be present for it. And sometimes people are asked this question, sometimes you say, you know, do you have to be on the other side of the room? No, it's too close. Well, what about, you know, across the road? Well, I think it's still too close. What about on top of that hill over there? And it's, sometimes people will say, oh yeah, if I'm at top of that hill, then I'm willing to just stay and be present and observe in my fear, my anger, what's going on. And so we don't get, but if we're closer, too close, it's too threatening, or pulled into its orbit or its gravity or something. And so being able to somehow get some distance from experience helps us to be a balanced, open observer of the phenomena without being swept away by it. So that's one option, just to be kind of, you know, to bird's eye view of the experience. And what does it take to awareness to back off awareness, and just so you kind of take a broad view of it all. Another approach of mindfulness, the Buddha said, is that of a surgeon. It seems that his idea of a surgeon in the old days is that before you make your cut into the skin, you would take your hands and you would poke around and feel all around the place you're going to cut. So you really know what's going on there as best you can, and so you can make the best possible surgery. And so the idea that you would probe or feel or and you know this intimacy of actually touching and really trying to feel what's there, get the information that's there, and really take it in a deeper, fuller way. So this is the opposite of the kind of being distant observer. This is being intimate and connected and present and really almost becoming one with the experience to really feel it and savor it and know it well. Sometimes this is really helpful. Some people find that then they can kind of really, the mindfulness and awareness is compelling and engaged, very nice. Both these ways are appropriate at different times with breathing. Sometimes it's nice with breathing to have a bird's eye view of breath, to kind of back, how far do you have to back off from your breathing so you're not controlling it? Just let it be, just let it do its thing. And other times it's really satisfying to go really right, dive right into the breath and become the breath and really feel the intimacy and the sensuality, the sensate qualities of each little twinge and movement of the breath. And it can be quite captivating and very interesting, very kind of satisfying to kind of sometimes to have that intimacy with the breathing or anything at all. So that's two ways. A third way that the Buddha talked about being mindful is that of being a gatekeeper. So in the old days, there was a wall around the towns, and there would be a gate, and there would be a gatekeeper who sat at the gate. And no one would be allowed into the city or out of the city without the permission of the gatekeeper. And so sometimes what we do with mindfulness, we sit at the junction of the inside and outside of our life, somehow the junction of various places where we have a choice about what we get involved in, what we let in, and what we let out. And if I'm sitting here meditating, minding my own business, and I feel hungry, and so then I start having recipe thoughts and planning what kind of food I'm going to have when I leave the retreat, and you know what cookbooks I should buy and the ingredients I'm going to get. And so if I'm a gatekeeper, I would be right there in the present moment, the gate of the present moment, and I'd see the arising of those thoughts, and the gatekeeper would say, you know, we're not going to get you involved. You're not going to get in here or out of here today. We're going to leave you alone. I'm not going to get involved. Or if we come down into the community hall downstairs, and someone in their infinite wisdom has decided that, it's probably nice for retreatants. They're kind of deprived of all kinds of things. And it would probably be nice to, put out a different sampling of major American newspapers, current newspapers, so that you can see the headlines probably be nice for you. And so maybe you know better than that on retreat to kind of get involved in that. You know that if you go down there and start seeing what some of the headlines are, that, you know, your mind will go off into some trip about something that you're. So you say, so the gatekeeper notices that, oh, there's this newspapers there. So, I'm not going to look in that. I wasn't going to look in that direction anyway, but now I'm not going to look in that direction, on the table down there. I'm going to keep walking towards the dining room or something, or get some tea. And so this ability to be in the present moment and to watch what the impulses are, what the inputs are, and what the outputs are, and to kind of track what's going on, is part of this movement of being a gatekeeper, being mindful. It's part of the function of mindfulness. And what that partly means is that mindfulness doesn't have to only be focusing on the breath, for example, or focusing whatever we're being mindful of, but sometimes it's also turning the attention around to how we are, how we're being aware, how we're trying, what are the thoughts, what are the feelings, what are the reactions we have, and to really track the inside and outside, kind of as if you're the gatekeeper who just sits there and watches and doesn't have to get involved, but can choose, help you choose what to get involved in, what not to get involved in. And this, in using this ancient analogy of the gatekeeper, the tradition talks about part of what the gatekeeper does is it follows the monarch's wishes. Whoever is the monarch of the realm, they tell the gatekeeper, let this people out, let these people in, you know, just, and the gatekeeper knows what the monarch wants. And so, I don't know exactly who the monarch is for us, but there is something about learning to kind of be a master of your own life, to be able to have some choice and know what's helpful for you and what's not helpful for you, know what to pick up and what to put down, what to leave alone. You know, you don't have to reject anything, but maybe you don't let it get into, into the kingdom where it, you get caught up in it and involved. So that was a third. So first was the kind of the bird's eye view. The second is the, the surgeon is probing. The third is to be the gatekeeper who kind of tracks where the places of choice, where we know where we can pick up and leave alone, things like that. And the fourth one of mindfulness is has to do with a cowherder, someone who herds cows. And the cows, you're tending the cows, they're wandering around the countryside, and they're during the growing season for the rice, they're very important that the cowherder stays very attentive to the cows, close to the cows, and constantly moves them this way and that so they don't go and eat the other farmers' rice. So you have to be right on top of the experience, right there, not letting anything kind of slip by where it causes damage. And however, when the rice has all been harvested, and it's a dry season, and then it's fine to let the cows just wander wherever they go because they're not going to cause any damage. And at that point, the cowherder can lean against a tree, sit down, lean against a tree, and just have a kind of panoramic kind of view of the countryside and keep kind of a general eye on the cows. And we know the cows are not going to cause any damage. So the cowherder can just be relaxed and spacious and panoramic. Doesn't have to be there right there to avoid causing damage. So sometimes it works this way for us. Sometimes I don't know what the best representation in us of cows are, but sometimes our thoughts, for example, are the cows. And some of our thoughts can cause a lot of damage. And can hurt ourselves. We can be very self-critical or have thoughts which are very mean. And sometimes our thoughts move in the direction of causing harm in the world around us. And so if we're not going to try to avoid causing that harm, we have to be there, right there, very close, watching very attentively so they don't get the upper hand. I learned this very early on in my Zen practice around self-pity. And unfortunately, I've had to learn it a few times since then. It's an ongoing lesson. I had a lot of knee pain. And in Zen, you're not allowed to move when you sit. I said, yesterday you can... You're welcome to move if you are in pain, but there was no such possibility in Zen. Just sit. Especially that rule applies particularly to young idealistic men, which I guess I was. So don't move. and so it was really excruciating. And there was one period of time where I was required to sit without moving for something like 3 to 4 hours a day at a time, four times a day, for five to ten days, and we didn't know if it was going where it was going to fall in that range, 5 to 10, someone else got to decide. So, and part of the decision was that if you move too much, then you had to sit longer. It's the rite of initiation into the monastery, which they have in Zen. So, um, So my knees were on fire. Boy, were they painful. And I learned that if I had self-pity, that my muscles around my knees would clamp up a little bit and it would hurt more. And if I was right there, you had to be very attentive, just right in the present moment, then I would catch myself going into self-pity and I would not get involved. I'd leave it alone. And my muscles, my knee would relax a teeny bit. And that difference, even though it hurt either way, it was just bearable if I had no self-pity. But with self-pity, it was unbearable. I wouldn't have managed. So that was kind of watching the cows really closely, so I wouldn't get involved. But at some point, you know, we're sitting, we're relaxed, we're at ease, we've learned not to pick things up, we've learned to leave things alone, we learn not to have, even if they're self-pity thoughts, to not get involved with them and not kind of be judged by them or pushed around by them or feel bad about them being there. But they just, thoughts just kind of float through. And they're not going to cause any damage. And so we just let them be. And they float by. And we can just kind of have a very panoramic, relaxed, very relaxed, soft, allowing, open awareness. And just, you know, whatever comes and goes can just be allowed to come and go and be. And we can just, all we have to do is make sure we're attentive to it. Just like the cow herder, to make sure to see the cows. We just have to be there. So what I'm trying to convey here is that awareness, mindfulness, can take different forms in different times. And our job is to learn a little bit and learn the territory about how it works. Not that you would remember everything I said here and try it all. But the important thing I wanted to convey is that mindfulness and awareness is not a singular thing, but rather you can begin exploring, how should I be present for this? How do I be present for this so I'm not so caught up in it, so I'm not reactive to it? How can I be present for this so I can really let it, really see it clearly, see it without the filter of my usual interpretations, my usual ideas of how it relates to me, myself, and mine? Just what is this in and of itself, this experience? How do I look at this? How do I see it? Where's the clarity of mind that I can have? So I said that I see mindfulness and awareness as synonymous, almost those words, sati and awareness. And one of the curious things about, if you look at how the Buddha talked about sati, mindfulness, what do we call mindfulness, he never used it, he never talked about it as something that you do, but more as something that you are, or something that you have, something you allow for. And one of the interesting experiments with awareness is what happens if, rather than you do awareness, you allow for it. Rather than doing awareness, you recognize you're aware. To recognize that you're aware, to allow yourself to be aware and to recognize, oh, I'm aware right now. Because awareness is something that is innate in human consciousness and human mental functioning. In ordinary waking states, you will be aware. And but sometimes when people hear the mindfulness instruction, they can hear it as if a lot of doing. I have to pay attention to this, bring my attention to the breath, bring my mind back. I have to do something with my awareness, and it can be a lot of work and be sometimes stressful to have a lot of sense of the doing and the doer of mindfulness. So what happens if you rather than do awareness, you allow for it? What if you, rather than doing awareness, you recognize that you're aware? You will be aware. Right now, there's awareness. You wouldn't know that I'm talking. You wouldn't know that maybe you have thoughts about what I'm saying, unless you were aware. And what happens if you recognize that you're aware? Oh, look at that. Oh, yeah. I know, there's knowing happening. Yeah, I know that I'm thinking. I know that I'm listening. I know that I'm perplexed by what Gil's saying. I know. And I'm aware of what's happening. And then do it again. and do it again. And begin to appreciate this act of awareness, appreciate this act of knowing. It's a miracle. It's one of the most amazing things, capacities that you have to be aware, to be mindful, and to learn to trust it or value it or cherish it and be intimate with it and let the world open up with it. It's a different world to live in when the world is in the field or in the room, space of awareness, than if you're not aware. It's almost like we have two different bodies. The body we have when we're not aware of it, and the body we have when there's awareness impregnating our body, moving through our body. There's two different kinds of breathing. The breathing we have when we're aware and we're not aware. Different kinds of minds, when you're aware of what's happening inside and when you're not aware. It's like just a whole different world. And so to begin appreciating the simple thing of awareness. And the simple, just awareness mantra, awareness by itself does not judge anything. Awareness by itself doesn't have any problems with anything. Awareness by itself doesn't have a desire for anything. Awareness by itself is just the act of being aware. So this mantra, just be aware. And then see what you do. See what's extra. See how the responses are. It's fine to have responses. It's not wrong to have responses and reactions. But it's really great to begin to tease these things apart and see, oh, this is awareness, and this is my wanting it to be different. I'm aware that I want it different, but let's allow for that awareness. Let's recognize that I'm aware. Remember that they're holding up the striker. You can focus on the striker, or you can focus on how you're holding the striker. You can want things to be different than what they are. You can focus on how you want them to be different and how terrible things are or whatever. Or you can focus on how you're aware of that, the knowing of that. It's a whole different part of the equation. I would say that it's the other half of life. And most people live in one half of life. When we know about awareness, we include the other half that's been missing. And it fills out. Life becomes fuller, more complete. When we kind of, oh, I'm aware. So in this instructions that the Buddha gave for developing awareness, developing mindfulness, he talked about such practices as observing what's happening, as knowing what's happening, understanding what's happening, clearly recognizing what's happening. Feeling what's happening. So all those are the activities that support, that bring forth, that help us to see awareness. And so those activities are not the point of practice. Those activities are what kind of are the catalyst or the supports to help us recognize awareness and let awareness become strong. So if I start looking at this bell, and observing it and really studying it carefully and really getting interested in it, at some point what I've become aware of is that in that interest, in that observation, awareness is standing out more in highlight, becomes stronger. The awareness is not the interest. The awareness is not the investigation. Awareness is not the feeling of it that goes on. But awareness is what allows all those things to happen. And you can just take a moment and pause and say, and recognize, oh, I'm aware right now. They're just awareness, simple awareness, just awareness. And that awareness can get stronger and stronger and more stable and kind of fill us and be here. And one of the reasons why this is considered useful in this path of mindfulness is that as awareness becomes stronger, it becomes less and less interesting for us to cling to things, less and less interesting to hold on to things. Not because we're supposed to not cling, we're supposed to let go, but because it's less interesting. It's kind of like as the snake grows, it sheds its skin. As awareness gets bigger, as we kind of fill in the other half of life and we kind of feel this fullness of just being here and present, it just becomes natural almost to kind of, well, who wants to hold on? Who wants to confine and limit and constrict. the openness that's happening, the fullness that's happening. And so letting go of clinging is maybe not such an interesting way of describing freedom. But maybe maybe the same thing happens as when we let go as happens when we open up. So we open up to all this. So what happens if you open to the experience of this moment as opposed to let go? Sometimes letting go sounds kind of depressing. But to open up, you have to do the same thing. You have to stop clinging or contracting around something. But to open up into awareness, into simple awareness, just this. So we observe. So we bring our attention to the breathing, for example, and we develop stability of attention there slowly over time. Just come back and do the simple act for the moment of being aware, observe, or feel, or explore, or watch it from the distance, or be the surgeon going in there really feeling it, or be the gatekeeper, or be the cowherder, maybe who has to kind of be very attentive so you don't get caught in things. Or if you're not in danger of being caught, you can be the cowherder who just takes it easy, rests against a tree, and just lets the world go by and be what it is. To begin exploring and be curious about the awareness, attention. What is this? What is it to be aware? And and perhaps the more challenging it is for you here, and I know these retreats can be challenging, the more valuable it is. So if you feel particularly challenged, take heart. That only means that it's actually something important is coming through and happening. And given the challenges you have, you might just drop the mantra into it. Just aware. What happens? Just aware. And what does that show you? What does that highlight? What does it teach you about how you're not just aware, how there's all kinds of other things happening? And when you see it, just see it. What happens to you? Just the seeing, just the awareness, just the knowing. And get curious. I encourage you to get curious and to notice what happens if all you do is clearly know what's happening. If you're clearly aware, what happens? What shifts and changes? Not immediately, but over time. It's an amazing process to be mindful, to be aware, to explore this side of ourselves, to be with ourselves this way. I hope that this talk, if nothing else, has encouraged you to give yourself over a little bit more to the sitting, the walking, to the practice here in the retreat with a certain degree of curiosity. What is this? What is going on here? What is awareness? Well, how is awareness right now? What is this space that awareness, the Gill says, makes space for things? What is the space that awareness creates? What does awareness allow for? What happens if I allow for awareness now? Just aware. Just awareness. I hope it's those two words will support you during this retreat. Just aware. So it's the custom here, many places, retreat centers, at the end of a Dharma talk to go back into the meditation posture for a moment and just kind of reconnect yourself into the meditative mode as we make the transition back into out of the Dharma talk mode.